huge capital outlays, onerous regulations, unions, and the persistent risk that if something were to go wrong, it could prove catastrophic. Why would anybody want to run an airline? With us today, two guests in a position to answer that question, Joel Peterson, the chairman, and Robin Hayes, the chief executive officer of JetBlue. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A professor at Stanford Business School, the founder of Peterson Partners, a private equity group, and the former chief executive officer of Trammell Crow, the enormous real estate company, Joel Peterson has served as chairman of the board of JetBlue since 2008. He holds an undergraduate degree from BYU and an MBA from Harvard. Mr. Peterson recently published The 10 Laws of Trust, Building Bonds That Make a Business Great. Robin Hayes joined JetBlue in 2008. He has served as the company's chief executive officer since 2015. Before joining JetBlue, Mr. Hayes worked for 19 years with British Airways. He holds a Bachelor of Science and a Master's degree in Engineering, both from the University of Bath in England. Joel and Robin, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Nice to be here.
So I want to know what the two of you think you're doing in the airline industry. But first, I have with me a man who was in the White House when President Trump met airline executives. Yeah. This is tricky because you're a publicly traded company, but what did you think of the president?
Well, actually, you know, it was very encouraging. I mean, we went in to talk about air traffic control reform, talk about the amount of regulation that airlines have to be on the receiving end of. And look, it was a very encouraging discussion. And the president, I think, really understands aviation and was keen to hear how we felt that we could create an even stronger growth engine in the U.S.
President Trump at the White House meeting, I'm quoting from a press account, "We have an obsolete plane system. We have obsolete airports," close quote. Now, as best I can tell, what he's getting at there is that air traffic control systems are still ground-based radar, and that's a system, the fundamentals of which date from the Second World War.
Right.
And all of us, we carry iPhones in our pockets that use global positioning satellites, are much more accurate.
Yep.
But as I further understand, transforming that system in airports across the nation from radar, ground-based radar, to GPS would be vastly expensive. Do you think he's serious?
I do. I mean, I think that the concept of reforming the air traffic control system, updating it and operating it more efficiently has actually goes back for 20 or 30 years.
Right. People have been trying this for a long time.
Exactly. And you know, most of the world has moved on and done this now and seen the benefits. So I think there's really two parts. One is the technology has to be upgraded. And secondly, there has to be a more steady source of funding than being subject to congressional budget cycles and sequestration and all the other things that the FAA have been through. So JetBlue, like most of the airline industry, supports moving the operating part of the air traffic control system, put it into a not-for-profit entity, have a board represented by all the stakeholders, including airlines, labor, government, and run it independently and let the FAA—
Get it out from under the FAA.
Exactly, and let the FAA focus on their core regulatory function of safety. They do an amazing job, and they should continue to regulate the industry from a safety perspective, but let the operating part of that, let a different entity run that.
Okay. Joel Peterson, I happen to know something about you. You lecture at the business school on entrepreneurship.
Correct.
And you have, and you've been there for a good long time now.
25 years.
25 years. And a lot of your students have gone on to found companies. Bonobos, you were the first investor in Bonobos. So you know a lot about the Silicon Valley model, which is a small handful of bright kids, $1 million at the most to get them started, a quick ramp, and you've got a really valuable company. Okay, that's a model you understand. Now let me describe another model to you. The airline business. Billions on aircraft before you even get one off the ground. You're dealing with unionized labor. You have to submit to regulations. Who knows whether this is true or not, but I saw the other day that FAA regulations run to 13 16,000 pages. And again, you have to live with the knowledge that if anything goes wrong, people could lose their... If something goes wrong with bonobos, my jeans don't fit. Something goes wrong with an aircraft, a large object holding people falls out of the sky. Add all that up and you've got Warren Buffett himself, who famously called airlines, quote, a death trap for investors. Joel, what are you doing at JetBlue?
We have to remember, I was in the real estate business for many
years. So this looks pretty good.
This looks pretty good. Yeah, real estate business is capital intensive, regulated. You have to lease it up all the time. It's cyclical. And I think JetBlue had an opportunity to build a brand and to do something different, to innovate in a commodity business. And that was exciting. I think we had a catchment area that was 6 million people out of JFK. We could fly
Started back east at JFK.
Started back east at JFK. So we had a phenomenal entrepreneur, really a visionary entrepreneur.
The data foundation of JetBlue is, what was the year it was founded?
99, I think.
Yeah, the first.
So you're the third CEO, as I remember.
Right. The first flight was in February 2000, but there was sort of a year to 18 months work before that to get it ready.
So the opportunity with which the company began, what was the business proposition that people talked themselves into believing when they invested in JetBlue?
So I can speak to that because I was one of the original investors.
Oh, you were? Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, okay, good. Yes, you
And can. It was that we could provoke demand. That we weren't going to be just stealing customers from legacy carriers, but that we could actually provoke demand by a new offering, by doing something different. And then we could build a brand. We could build loyalty. We could do things differently from what was being done.
Okay, Robin, your turn. You have degrees in engineering.
Yes.
You could have done something with your life. You could have started a software company yourself. Instead, here you are, CEO of an airline. And before that, 19 years at BA, British Airways.
Right.
So what was it?
Well, I always loved airplanes, and when I left university to do my first job, I worked for an avionics company. We manufactured military avionics equipment, and so I was, playing around with airplanes then. And
so really, this all goes back to a kind of boyish romance with flying?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, interestingly enough, I didn't take my first flight till I was 18 years old. So, because, we lived in England and we kind of vacationed just usually very domestically. And so I was very late taking my first flight. But I always loved airplanes and loved being around them and still do. I mean, I don't know what else I would do. I'm certainly not an academic, but I love airplanes, Peter.
All right. So you've given me a rough description of what the two of you are doing. One more question before I want to talk about the business, the way you think about the business. From an investor's point of view today, your stock is trading at about $20 a share, maybe a little under $20 a share today. There was a high of about $27 in 2015, I think, and a low of what, about $13 in the summer of 2016, if I'm remembering the, mm-hmm. the high and the low correctly, about $20. Market cap of a little over $6 billion. What kind of investor should want JetBlue in his portfolio? What does JetBlue do for a portfolio?
Go ahead, Rob.
I think we very much historically been a growth company. So Joel's right. If you think about the early days, JetBlue was still all about stimulating demand and creating new markets, and we've continued to do that. And so, I think that whilst we have sort of different investors in our shareholder mix, we have some very long-term shareholders who have sort of been with us for a while and been on that journey for us. And I think one of the changes we've seen in the US in the last few years is how really airlines have gone. There's been so much consolidation. There's so few airlines left that, I remember 15 years ago when I sort of early on in my career, you would dream of making a 10% operating margin. And now in the
US... That
was
your margin last year, is that right?
Oh, well, no. I mean, our margin, and we closed with 2016, was just under 20%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay,
so, sorry. And the industry average was around 17-18%. So you can see that the airline in the US, the rest of the world, different story. And so I think about the US industry and JetBlue in particular, there's a very sustainable long-term business model that... even now in the toughest of years and in the economic down cycles, is still capable of producing double-digit operating
margins. So your pitch to investors is still, at this stage in the company's life, it is not, we're a coupon, we'll give you a steady. Your pitch to investors is still pretty simple. Go long, JetBlue, this is still a growth company. Is that, I've got that? Okay. Yeah. Robin Hayes in an interview last August, quote, we have amazing customer loyalty, mm-hmm. close quote. That's quantifiable, is it?
Yes.
Okay, prove it to me. Go ahead.
Well, we measure customer loyalty in a number of ways, but I think that we are seen as a very early innovator of customer NPS, Net Promoter Score. So we survey a large number of customers on all aspects of their journey, and we continue to win every single year. We've now won J.D. Power, Best Airline for Customer Satisfaction in North America for 12 years in a row.
That's staggering.
And, one of the best things when I joined JetBlue, and you sort of put that JetBlue on ID, you know, you take the BA ID off and you put the JetBlue ID on, people stop you in the street and say, I just love JetBlue. And we know we're not perfect, but when we get it wrong, we try and make it right quickly.
Joel, here's an airline analyst. I found this online, a fellow called Harley Manning, and he's quoted last year in the Business Insider, quote, JetBlue is full of personality with a little attitude in a nice way, close quote. And I have to say, that's the way I feel. JetBlue has personality. But listen to those words, personality, attitude, niceness. You are flying large tin cans in the sky. There are only a couple of suppliers. Everybody buys their airplanes from Boeing or, as you do, from Airbus. There are only so many routes. You fly the same routes as your competitors. You are dealing with the same unions as your competitors. You are under the same regulations. How do you achieve, and yet you've got this brand that people love enough to fly JetBlue over your competitors whenever they can, and analysts who are supposed to be the hard-boiled people on Wall Street talk about niceness and personality. How do you do that?
Well, I think that says a lot about the experience that most people have on airlines. It's not great.
Horrible.
And so JetBlue really tries hard. We try harder, the old Avis. We really try. And I think the other thing is that we have a culture, an internal culture. It was Peter Drucker who said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And the power of culture is really strong. So people like each other. The board likes management. Management likes the board. We solve problems. And I think the other element is that we have innovated. You know, JetBlue has done a lot of innovation. And so we're always aware.
Innovated. Now, give me a few examples, because you mean innovated in the customer experience?
Yes.
You're designing cabins and giving free, designing comfortable seats and designing, giving free Wi-Fi, that kind of thing?
Wi-Fi. I think the TVs and the seat backs was the first one that probably had the biggest impact.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of friends who come to me and say, I won't fly anything else because my kids, this used to be, want to see the TVs and the seat backs. So I think there's a lot of things like that.
So describe culture to me. Here you are, CEO. There's only one of you. Mm-hmm. Chairman, there's only one of you. You employ about 20,000 people. Isn't mm-hmm. that's the correct number in round numbers?
We just had our 20,000th crew member join a few weeks ago.
Yep. Okay, yep. So you employ 20,000 people.
Yeah.
How do you achieve quality control, so to speak, across human beings? How do you extend that culture across a workforce that large?
Well, let me just tell a story on Robin. All right. Then Robin sits back.
Cut.
Yeah, he sits back with the passengers that are flying in the second cabin, and he helps clean the plane. He serves snacks. He talks to customers, and that rubs off on flight attendants, on pilots, and so there's this sense that we're all crew members. Mm-hmm. So in JetBlue, we don't talk about employees. People are crew members. So there's an executive crew, there's tech ops, but everybody's a crew member. And there's this sense that our job is, number one, safety, mm-hmm. and number two is to delight customers. Mm-hmm. And so we train people to delight customers. And that's different.
I think it starts on the first day. You know, David Neeleman, who was the founder of JetBlue, brilliant entrepreneur, and then Dave Barger, who was the second CEO, another great leader. You know, Dave hired me. It all starts on the first day. Every single new JetBlue crew member on their first day of employment will be down at JetBlue University in Orlando, and their first session, their first module, is with the CEO of the company. And that's where we meet all of our new team for the first time. There'll be a whole team of leaders that come through that day. So that very much sets the tone, because that's where we can talk about the importance of culture. You know, what we say to our crew members is, if we take care of you, you'll take care of the customers, and it's as simple as that. You know, David Neeleman used to coin the phrase that we're a customer service company that happens to fly airplanes. And finally, I would say, Peter, it's about giving our people the tools to do the job. So we invested last year in putting all of our US-based airport crew members through hospitality training. 3 days of hospitality training per crew member.
Which is expensive.
Which is a big investment, but it gives them the tools. We can't just have these expectations of our crew members and each other if we don't equip them for success. And so we've been able to see that, and we've been able to see where that's taken off and where we've had to go back and do a little bit more work. But the crew members have been really thankful for some of those basic training tools.
Okay. Business minds at work. I'm going to take, let's do case studies. You're a business school man. Let's do a couple of case studies drawn from the recent history of JetBlue. And I would just like to hear how you thought through the business problem. Spring of last year, you attempted to purchase Virgin America. And in the end, you got outbid by Alaska Airlines. Why did you want Virgin in the first place? And why did you permit yourselves to be outbid? Who do I go with on this one?
Maybe I'll start, and then Joel can correct me. You know, we've ever since the first day of JetBlue, we've been very much focused on organic growth, because we see culture. You know, we don't have the network of the big legacy airlines, right? So culture is very.
You're the fifth largest airline.
We were, but now we're the sixth. Because,
oh, I see. You know, all right.
But
because of this deal.
But culture really is what makes customers choose us, even when they could fly with somebody else, and it's our people. And so we've already been focused on organic growth. When the Virgin opportunity came up, the first thing we asked ourselves was, culturally, can we make this work? Because we don't want to destroy our culture just to acquire another airline. And I think we felt, as a leadership team and a board, that there was a good culture fit between the two organizations.
If anybody would describe another airline as having personality, it would have been Virgin America.
Exactly. Right. And you know, we had differences, but we felt that we could be better together. The second thing it accomplished for us was building our West Coast presence. You know, with our Mint premium experience,
we don't
call first class. With that, we'd build a stronger presence on Transcon. This would have helped us, and it would have built our intra-West presence as well. So that's why we wanted Virgin America, and I'll let Joel tell you.
And why did you decide you didn't want it quite that much?
It was a question of economics. In the end, we set a price and said, you know, this is our walk-away price. We may have ooched a little bit at the end, but really we were bumping up against what we thought the value was. And I think Alaska paid a full price.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this was a stock that was trading in the sort of 20s, and the company was sold
Virgin.
For, 57. And so we got to a point where we felt that it was a better option to build our plan organically.
Okay.
And
it'll take us longer.
It'll take us longer. But we even, you know, last June, we purchased an additional 30 airplanes.
Which is a capital outlay of?
You know, about $1.5 billion to $2 billion, depending on.
But it's over time.
It's over time.
So it never really happened. You never really spend it.
But by the way, you know, back to my point earlier, Peter, about the health industry, every single airplane we took delivery of last year, we paid with cash. We haven't been into the debt markets for nearly 3 years now to finance airplanes. And so it's a very healthy company that is able to pay for its own growth.
All right, Mint. Not long after losing the Virgin deal to Alaska, JetBlue began its new Mint service. This is lie flat seats and then more personal service in that forward cabin. But something like this might have seemed obvious for other airlines. Upgrade first class. For you, it was a large departure, because JetBlue's had a strong emphasis on a kind of egalitarian experience. There was no such thing as first class or business class in JetBlue. It was just JetBlue from one end of the aircraft to the other. So, question, how controversial was installing what is, I know you don't call it first class, but layman would call it first class. How controversial was it on the board, in the C-suite, in your headquarters in Long Island City? How controversial was this? How hard a decision
Maybe
was
I'll
it?
Start, yes? And then Joel can give the bold perspective. So, first of all, it was very controversial internally.
Was this your idea?
It was the team.
That it's worked out,
success has many fathers, but failure never does, right?
So Robin was an initial champion. He was an early champion.
Okay. We got there because we were looking at our performance as a company, and we had a real challenge on the transcon routes, you know, the east to west coast, because we were suffering a significant unit revenue disadvantage versus everyone else, and we really had two paths, either to pull down a lot of that flying and focus it more north-south, or secondly, find a way of winning in that market. And the reason we went with the second was that more north-south was fine, but
when you say north-south, you mean that
northeast to Florida.
Right, right. And you're big in the Caribbean.
Yeah, we were already really strong there, you know, and part of what a growing airline has to do as you get bigger is to diversify.
Right.
And so we kind of, as a leadership team, we came up with this concept of how we felt we could win in the premium segment. We wanted to set ourselves the challenge of offering the best product at a price point that really was lower because the large airlines were gouging customers with very high fares and poor service back then. And so we came up with the Mint concept, but it was controversial. We had heaps of meetings internally, a lot of concern around the culture and what it would do and how our customers react to that. And in the end, we got there by saying, you know what, if we can make the experience in Mint amazing, but also improve it for all of our other customers on the airplane who aren't flying Mint, then everyone wins. And that's exactly what we did. But Joel, your take on the board, because we had some fairly heated board discussions, right?
The board was divided on it. And by the way, I've been on 35 boards.
Your whole
years.
Competitive advantage is your culture.
Yeah.
And this is something that was messing with the culture, or could have, right? But this is a big deal, right, as a business decision.
But I actually think conflict is a healthy thing. I really think you get to better decisions. The board is highly respectful of each other and of management. So there were debates. Robin actually mocked up the seating. And as a board, we went down and we sat in the seats, different pitch seats. I remember that. And people said, no, this won't work. This is too tight. And he was really playing more with the core product. And just to say, can we
deliver? The core product meaning what a layman would call the economy seating.
Exactly. Yes.
So you were serious about trying to improve that at the same time as you installed
Mint. Oh, yeah, and we did. I mean, if you go on the 321s that have Mint and they go to the core product, we have a great seat. We have a 100 channels of live TV. We now have free movies you can start and stop. And we introduced drinks and a food pantry where customers could go and help themselves to soft drinks and snacks.
Oh, really?
And that wasn't just the exclusive preserve of the business class customer, or as we say, the Mint customer.
Yes, yes.
It was for everybody. And so it gave us the opportunity to improve the experience for everybody in the airplane.
Okay. Last of these sort of case study questions here. Just, I want to see how your minds work on these questions. You're not an ultra discounter. Mm-hmm. You're not competing with Southwest. And yet at the same time, although you're very strong in the East Coast and Caribbean, you're just now building out the transcontinental West Coast to East Coast. Mm-hmm. Can't fly JetBlue to Europe. Can't fly JetBlue to Asia, so you're not competing with the long-haul, gigantic network operations. You're not competing with them, but you're smaller. Mm-hmm. So you're neither one thing nor the other. Mm-hmm. Ultra discounter, gigantic worldwide networks, mm-hmm. and here's JetBlue. Mm-hmm. Are you happy there? Is that tenable to be sort of in the middle?
Oh, you know, I absolutely do. And it's funny because we've demonstrated, actually, I believe, that when you create an airline that's focused on culture and the customer, you can drive superior returns for your owners and shareholders. And, you know, I think last year was a great example where we outperformed the vast majority of the industry, and yet we experienced the highest levels of customer satisfaction. And our own crew members voted as one of the top 10 companies to work for in America on the Forbes top 500. So, you know, I think we are doing it. Now, we don't obviously have the network of the large legacies, but we have a...
But you want them, don't you?
Well, we've only been around 17 years, right? So Every year we're growing a little bit. I mean, Southwest, which is a great airline, you know, Southwest have been around now for over 45 years, right? So it just takes time to build that.
But so whenever Robin comes in and says to the board, ladies and gentlemen, we have an opportunity to add some roots here. Is there a culture test that the board imposes? I mean, it would seem to me that this culture that you've built, where again, I go back to personality and attitude and niceness, and airline travel is in general so miserable that if you find something that's pleasant, okay, fine, I've made that point. But it has to be related, or at least it could be related to size. You can get too big to be able to do what you guys do well. Is that right? Does the board worry about that constantly?
Well, I think you worry about the dilution of the culture and growing too fast. And Robin gets pushback if he wants to go too far, too fast. But he's very sensitized to this kind of thing. So it's not a big fight. It's just measured growth. And the question is, can you have pricing power? Are you able, is this really a commodity business that really the flight that is $3 cheaper is going to get the customers? And I think it's really more than that. I think it's a question of frequency, convenience, the airport, the status of the planes, how you're treated getting on, how fast you can check in. I mean, there's a whole, what we call the JetBlue experience. Mm-hmm. We want the JetBlue experience to have people say, I'm loyal to this. I'll fly JetBlue.
JetBlue in Silicon Valley. Transportation as a sector in Silicon Valley. We know the trucking industry. If you're Fred Smith at FedEx, you are thinking hard right now about the driverless revolution that's coming at you. Or if you're at Ford, Ford just spent $1 billion to acquire an artificial intelligence company. They have an office here in Silicon Valley that employs, I think it's something like 300. It's a pretty big presence out here. Apple and Google are both building their own driverless cars. That's ground transportation. JetBlue last year set up its own operation, its own investment entity, JetBlue Technology Ventures, here in Silicon Valley. And the day after tomorrow, you two fellows are having a board meeting here.
Correct.
So Silicon Valley is important to you, and I want to know why. What disruptions do you see coming?
So as an investor, I look at tech-enabled businesses that are existing businesses, where they're not new technologies that are starting some whole new field. Those exist out there. But we're a large industry, and tech-enabling that industry, you know, Robin talked about the ATC, you know, the technology improvements that can happen there. But in everything, in checking in maintenance, I mean, there's all kinds of things where you can improve operations through technology. We want to be at the cutting edge of all that. We want to know everything that's going on.
So your attitude, your approach to Silicon Valley is not, I don't know what the Ford executives are thinking, but let's say if you're running a car company, you could say to yourself, oh my goodness, they're coming for us. We need to be out there if only as a matter of self-defense. You're not thinking that way. You're thinking there are all kinds of incremental ways in which we can purchase or at least expose ourselves to technology to do what we do now better. Is that, correct?
I think it's primarily what Joel said, which is, you know, it's funny, I tell a Joel story now. You know, Joel is obviously the cutting edge at Stanford, and so he used to send me all these smart people with these ideas, and he used to send it to me, and I used to send it to my team, and not much would happen with it. And you'd kind of get into, and the reason not much would happen with it is the airline was so busy when we got these things, we were looking at it through a very traditional lens, and it wasn't set up for some more innovative kind of thinking.
You're busy with airplanes.
Yeah, they're busy with airplanes. No one's thinking about let's invest in this business and how do we use it. So by the primary goal of setting up Tech Ventures was really now we have a footprint here in this amazing, innovative technology landscape, and we are getting run over in the crowd by all these things, all these ideas that are now coming into our airline that we're already seeing ways we can become more efficient, more productive, and more innovative. And where,
can you name an example, or is it still too tentative?
No, I mean, not happy to name examples. Using new technology in our contact centers to help us interact with customers in their chosen means, whether it's social media, phone call, email. Looking at how.
You mean if I call JetBlue,
yeah,
it is not your aim to keep me on hold until I finally give up?
Right, but why do you have to call? Why can't you contact us how you want to? We're looking at new ways of tracking ground equipment in the airport. It's making sure we know where different bits of equipment are. Very important from a safety perspective that you know equipment is not sort of being blown out or hasn't been chopped. So loads of examples. But it's also that I think a secondary objective is we've seen other parts of the travel sector, whether it's ground transportation or lodging, we've seen them significantly disrupted over the last 5 years by new entrants. And a lot of airline experts will say, well, that can't happen to us. But you know, that's what the hotels said before Airbnb came along. And so we now have one foot in that camp. And if the industry is going to be disrupted, then we want to be part of it. We've made we've taken an investment in a company called Flyer, which is looking at how
FLYR?
Yeah, how the pricing model can be disrupted for airlines. And so we're getting smarter in that as well. And we have a terrific leader in Bonnie Simi and Raj, who's there on the team, and they're doing some amazing things.
Last couple of questions here. Public policy. Robin was listening to the president earlier this week, President Trump. If you could talk to, now forget about talking to President Trump. I think it may be hard to get his attention just at the moment. But chairman of JetBlue, you actually, this here is an operation and you're running the operation. What are the public policy implications? If you could tell the government of the United States how to make the airline industry better from the point of view, not the profitability of your investors, although I wouldn't denigrate that, but from the point of view of customers, people who are traveling from place to place, you must see things all the time that the government could do better. What would you say, Joel?
Well, I'd say air traffic control, which we've talked about. Probably the open.
Do we have what in Britain? What kind of air traffic control system do they have? Is it still ground-based radar?
It's a mixture of ground-based and satellite.
But so they're ahead of us.
Well, but yeah, but it's operated by a different company outside the government.
Okay, so go ahead. So air traffic.
Yeah, I think open skies treaties. You know, that would give us a chance to fly other countries. I think that there's some limitations there on how open skies works.
I see.
What else, Robin, in terms of government?
What would you add?
I would add deregulation. I mean, I do think that...
we are a deregulated industry.
Well, I mean,
we're the most regulated, deregulated industry.
I know, that's... Yeah. Right. Yeah.
No, and I think, look, I want to make it very clear, like, there is no pushback at all from JetBlue or any airline on the safety regulation because we're very proud and the FAA should be very proud of what's been achieved in the U.S. industry over the last 20, 30 years. It's world-class and can't be beaten. We have amazing air traffic controllers and pilots every day who operate in that system and tech ops crew members. But there's a lot of other regulations. So for example, regulations that impose how airline can distribute the products and who you have to send in the distribution chain, travel agents direct, how you price it. Airlines have to include tax in the total, whereas pretty much every other industry, you buy your products and then the sales tax or the tax is added on top of that. Most people don't know that 21% of their air ticket goes to the government in tax. So a family of five traveling on vacation, and one of the tickets that you're buying is
for the government.
Straight to the government. And money gets diverted out of aviation to close the budget surplus. So, you know, customers pay TSA fees.
You just mentioned the three letters that I was waiting for the two of you to mention.
TSA. TSA.
Is there no? Wouldn't you love it if customers arrived at the gate a little happier, if they hadn't been patted down and made to stand?
I actually think
is there no way to do TSA better?
I actually think they've made huge improvements and huge strides. And Admiral Neffinger, who was the previous administrator, who I knew well, I think. Did a great job with his team. I mean, the pre-check, I think, is a fantastic product for customers that go through it. And I think that they're very focused now on times. I mean, every morning, I now get a report of all the top airports in the country and how long the TSA waits were.
Oh, really?
And so we can then work with the TSA. And that transparency wasn't there before. So I actually think the TSA do a very difficult job. I mean, at the end of the day, their job is to keep us safe.
Joel, if you could wave a wand and have it follow, that this would happen, would you wave the wand? And the question is, Robin said, leave safety with the FAA, but air traffic control, we can do a better job of that, set up an independent agency. Do you want TSA run by the federal government? Could the airline set up an independent agency that would do it more efficiently?
It's being done privately in some places.
Yeah.
So I think that option is being looked at.
Yeah.
I think there's a number of things that are being looked at.
I just don't see any passion on the... You don't feel my pain as I go through TSA.
There is a program today where under the TSA model, certain airports can be privatized, have operators run it on behalf of the TSA. Most people don't know that because when you go through...
Are they any better?
We don't see a difference in the...
I don't think we see any difference.
All right.
But his issue is, I think something like PreCheck, I think that's a terrific product for people who fly a lot. I mean, that really was a great partnership with TSA, Customs Border Protection. And I do worry that had you a sort of a patchwork quilt of private operators running all that, I think that would have been much harder to do.
All right. That's my pet peeve, and enough of that. Back to JetBlue. Last couple of questions here. Robin, in an interview last year, described the difference between British Airways, mm-hmm. where he worked for 19 years, and JetBlue. Quote, the biggest difference was that BA was an incumbent.
Yeah.
And so the whole mentality was around defending its strength. Mm-hmm. JetBlue is a challenger brand. Mm-hmm. Close quote. How long can you keep it up?
So I have to say that I invested in an airline that took BA on directly. And Robin put us out of business.
That's not true. There was a very competitive industry,
and he came up with a workaround.
So you have crushed challengers in your past life.
He understands how to win as an incumbent.
But isn't it just inherent that in time, the longer you're in business, the more successful you are, the more you become an incumbent, because the more you have to lose. How do you handle that as a business problem?
Well, to me, it's a question of culture and innovation. If you can keep those two things alive, and that's why I look at something like JetBlue Ventures out here, where we just said, we're going to remove it from New York. We have an airline
Your
to
investment
run there.
Firm here in Silicon Valley.
Our investment firm here is Silicon Valley, and we're going to innovate here. And so I think as you keep piloting, sunsetting, hiring people that look at things differently, you can continue to innovate for a long, long time. There's some very innovative companies that are fairly large.
You know, I think we're about to undergo a digital eclipse here. And we've just actually, so we're thinking as JetBlue very much how we want our digital brand presence to evolve over the next few years. And we've actually, again, we looked at how we were doing things, and we've just, there's some great new space in a building called the New Lab in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in New York. And we're moving our digital development team over there, so we can kind of really incubate a startup. And it's different to tech ventures, because that's more about outside in. This is how we innovate digitally within JetBlue. And I think providing we can continue to innovate, providing we continue to remember that culture is what truly separates us, and also work very hard to maintain our cost advantage, because that's the other thing. Part of how you can go in and grow and lower fares is if you have a cost structure advantage against your competitors. We started flying Boston LaGuardia on October 31st last year. Fares came down 70%. The market was stimulated to a massive fashion.
Overall fares?
The World Cup
fare. You drove the whole market.
The
down.
World Cup fare came down 70%, because what happens is legacy airlines, and there's only three of them left now, they will sit there, they will charge very high fares.
United,
American, and Delta.
Got it.
They will sit there, they will charge very high fares. And then what happens is when a new entrant comes in, they will lower the fares to try and make life hard and drive the new entrants off. So you need a low cost structure for that to happen. So we've always done that. We've always been about lowering fares. And so now you can fly between Boston and LaGuardia, New York and Boston, much more cheaply. And so providing we can continue to all of that, first day orientation, that's what I say to all our new crew members. You know, we'll be here in another 17 years, providing we continue to have a great culture, innovate with great products, and maintain our cost advantage.
Okay. You also, speaking of innovation, you also flew the first regularly scheduled flight from Miami to Havana.
Fort Lauderdale to Havana.
Fort Lauderdale
but
to
close,
Havana.
Peter.
Thank you. Well, you know, a television business, as long as you're in the general area.
August 31, 2016.
Why? Are you going to make money on that route?
We will eventually. I mean, the Dominican Republic is now so important to JetBlue. Cuba is going to take some time to ramp up. But you know, our crew members wanted to be first.
All right. All right. Last question. Joel, this is profound. Don't feel you have to answer without thinking it over first. Window or aisle?
It depends on if it's a night. If it's night, it's window. If it's day, it's the aisle.
Robin, window or aisle?
Aisle. I'm up and down the whole time, so I can't be just walking over.
Do you fly red eyes?
I do fly red eyes occasionally. I'm more of a daylight person.
All right.
Okay, I fly more red eyes.
Joel Peterson, chairman of JetBlue and the author of The 10 Laws of Trust, and Robin Hayes, chief executive officer of JetBlue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Robinson for the Hoover Institution and Uncommon Knowledge. Thank you.